very much. So it's a pleasure being back in PI, even an honor being here in Time Room on this side of the room, if slightly scary maybe. Okay, so I would like to present some results, which are analytic bootstrap results pertaining to defect CFTs. We found these results with Madalena Lemos, Pedro Liendo, and Suraf Sarkar. Madalena and Pedro are in Hamburg, and Suraf is moving to Porto this September, I guess. So let me first start with an overview of the topic. So I would like to introduce the topic. In particular, I would like to give a brief introduction to defect CFT, mostly to set up notations and set up the problem I would like to solve or make progress on. I would like to describe then a formula, which is an integral kernel that takes some correlation function in the presence of a defect and gives back the spectrum of the local operators on top of the defect. I'm going to define what I mean in a second. But in practice, this is kind of an efficient way to do conformal block decomposition of correlation function that has become fashionable these days. There's a famous famous formula by Simon Caron-Wu. And this is another example of this kind of inversion formula. And I would like to use this formula to extract some analytic information when some dimensionless number, which is present in every defect CFT, becomes large. This is this transverse spin I'm going to describe in a moment. And then I will conclude with, if time permits, with an example, which I would like to go pick in the domain of entanglement entropy, just in order to, I hope, like demonstrate that this topic has interest in various areas of theoretical physics. So let's start. Then let's start with CFTs. So for this talk, a CFT is just going to be a set of local operators, and mostly I'm gonna call phi external operators, after which I want to measure correlation functions, and curly O operators that are exchanging their OPE. So a CFT is a set of local operators together with a conformal invariant and convergent OPE. And basically, that's it. The only thing I would like to recall from this formula, which is an example of a primary operator traceless symmetric, because I'm going to consider only scalar external operators, so they can only exchange traceless symmetric operators, is that if I consider the OPE not in the Euclidean region, but in a more general region in space-time, I could send to zero the distance of the operators without sending to zero the single components here. So basically, so what follows is that the operators with the lowest twist, or the twist is delta minus j, will dominate in the OP. And it will be important, as usual in this in the context of analytic bootstrap, that the twist is bounded in unitary theories for scalar and for higher spin operator. Oh, yeah. So j equals zero, j bigger. Okay, this is basically enough for CFTs and local operators. So what about non-local operators? What I would like to study is a setup in which in the correlation function I insert some extended operator, which I would like to probe. So extended operators are actually fairly ubiquitous, I think, in conformal field theories in particular. Well, the basic example, the simplest example, which for reasons that are going to become clear in a moment, I'm not going to treat, is boundaries. So boundaries and interfaces have been perhaps they're the best studied examples. They are effect of life in condensed matter physics, so they're important. Other examples of non-local operators which we might be interested in are line defects like Wilson lines or Toff lines. So these are probes that sometimes encode a very deep, very basic feature of the conformal field theory of interest, for instance, gauge invariance. Other examples are surface defects. Among the surface defects, this example I would like to describe then in the last part. For instance, in four dimensions, a surface defect is the Reni replica defect, which is useful in computing Reni entropies. So more generally, what I would like to take as a definition of a conformal defect is any extended operator, which is any modification of the theory along a submanifold whose dimension I'm going to call P. So that's dimension P and has codimension Q, so that P plus Q gives the space-time dimension. So an extended modification of the theory which preserves all the symmetries which are not broken by the surface I choose. In practice, I will always restrict to the case of a flat or spherical defects. These are the same thing under conformal transformation. So the symmetries which are preserved by the support in this case are just a conformal group on the defect times rotations around the defect. So rotations, I'm going to call these rotations transverse rotations, and the conformal transformations in p dimensions. So this is not a very big description of restriction, of course, because what I would like to actually study is the spectrum of excitations on top of this defect. This is meaningful observables. So we would like to probe the defect at some point by inserting a local operator, measure its spectrum. Of course, if the defect is some generic shape, you could imagine to tackle that more general case in conformal perturbation theory. You start with a flat defect and then you start deforming it. This will insert local operators. So in principle, if you know the full spectrum of local operators on top of a defect, you will also know its expectation value when it's not flat. So it's in principle a complete set of observables. What are these local operators on top of the defect described by? Well, they have quantum numbers which are selected by the Cartan of this group. So they will have some scaling dimension, delta hat, and some spin along the defect. And they will have a global quantum number, S, which is related to this orthogonal rotations. So in the next part, in the following, I will not be concerned by the spin along the defect. And this is pretty easy to understand by looking at this formula. So this formula is, second line, is what I call, what people call a defect of P. And it's just a statement that in particular, if I bring the defect close, if I bring the operator close to the defect, it's going to be possible to expand it into local operators on top of the defect. And this also is an expansion that should be conformal invariant, so it's fixed up to a few numbers, infinitely many, but a few numbers. In particular, if this operator is a scalar, it only exchanges scalar operators on the defect with perhaps some charge under transverse rotations, which is this. These indices I. So in the notation I'm using, I is a coordinate orthogonal to the defect, A is a coordinate parallel to the defect. Okay, so this quantum number S is what I like to call the transverse spin. And it is present in any defect CFT. So a defect CFT is a special, so the theory on top of the defect is a special conformal field theory, which is slightly non-local. It's not expected to have a stress tensor, and is always endowed with a global symmetry. We'll see that it's the result of this analysis will be that it's actually slightly more special than that. In particular, it's not possible to just pick a random theory which has a global symmetry and couple it to a higher dimensional conformal field theory. This global the charges. The scaling dimension of these operators will not be unrelated from the charge. So it's a kind of a special lower dimensional conformal field theory.
Are there conserved currents for the SOQ?
No, there's well, I mean, yes, it's a global symmetry, but there's no stress sensor actually, so I'm not sure if there have to be one. So, well, actually, yeah, so there is a stress. So, okay, the answer is that the answer is no, there doesn't need to be a local current on the defect. What is generating rotations around is the current for rotation, which is the rotational current of the bulk CFT. So, there is a stress sensor in the bulk CFT. It has the usual current, which is T mu nu times the Killing vector associated to the rotations, and this generates the full rotational symmetry of the theory. This is also the reason why we shouldn't expect, if there was a current under this rotational symmetry localized on the defect, it's one hint that actually the theory is decoupled, that you can rotate the defect without affecting the rest of the operators in the bulk. So it's almost the same reason why you don't expect the stress sensor at all to live on the defect. You don't want a Hamiltonian that evolves you along the defect without doing nothing to the local operators in the bulk. Okay, so...
Sorry, just a more basic question. Is a defect always an operator, not, say, a non-local operator in the Hilbert space? Or is it something... Or can it be fancier than that?
Fancier...
Well, for instance, I'm thinking... I know very little about this, but I know that there exist these duality defects where, you know, something that where you sort of dualize operator as you cross it.
So usually...
How to express that as a Hilbert space operator?
Good. So, okay. So from the point of view of what I'm doing, the only thing I need is the symmetry that it preserves. But it needs to break something. So just to take an example, the duality defect is usually a topological defect. It's something that you can, since it implements as almost a symmetry, it's a duality, so it's you just pick a correlation function on local operator, you swipe this defect across, and the correlation function becomes the correlation function in the dual theory, still translational invariant. In particular, it doesn't break any on the conformal symmetry, so it would be a very simple defect from this point of view. The Hilbert space description of a local of an extended operator, in general, I would. So this is not a new, at least in a CFT, this is not a new operator. So we're used to think that the set of local operators are a basis in the Hilbert space in radial quantization, and that's all what we need. And this is true, right? We can. It's true because I can always pick that flat defect, make it into a sphere, cut the path integrals on a larger sphere, and replace. So this defect will create a state in radial quantization, and by state operator correspondence, I can express this state as a sum over local operators. So it's always a state in radial quantization. The point with all what I'm saying is that it's not a random combination of local operators placed at the origin. It has to obey constraints, and these constraints are bootstrap constraints. So there is a crossing equation, well, more than one, but in particular one I'm going to focus on, which what is doing is actually to fix. So there are some coefficients ci and local operators oi times by dimensional analysis the radius of the defect. So I would like to put constraints on these guys indirectly. I mean, it's another way you could say what I'm doing. Put constraints on these guys using a bootstrap equation. Does this answer the question? Okay. Okay. Good. So, yeah. So this leads me to the actual bootstrap constraints I would like to use, which is just the simplest possible bootstrap constraints. I take a two-point function of identical operators in the presence of this effect, and I just expand it into two OPEs that I have. So I will have that can expand these operators on the defect, so using the defect OPE, or I can first fuse them, and then, so when I fuse them, I'm using the first line above, and then what I get are one-point functions of local bulk operators. Okay, so I would like to study this equation. And okay, in order to study this equation in a useful way, I would like to choose coordinates. So these points can be moved around using conformal transformations. And in particular, I can always choose the following coordinates. I will put my defect like going out over on the blackboard. So in particular, at this point, it should be clear why I don't want to consider boundaries of interfaces, because I want to have this transverse spin. So this rotational symmetry around the defect must be non-trivial. So I need to have codimension at least 2. So I'm going to use the blackboard as a plane orthogonal to the defect. And I will place one of the two operators at distance 1 and the other operator some coordinate z and z bar complex coordinate around the defect. So this is my configuration. I can always do that with conformal transformations and using also scale invariance, then it follows that the two-point function is a function only of these two numbers. It will also be convenient to have to use r and theta, so it should be understood that sometimes when I mention r and theta, these are just polar coordinates. So good. And then what is the bootstrap constraints written in terms of g? So it's going to be something like sum over defect operators on one side, so they're quantum numbers. I have some couplings of defect operators. I have some some conformal blocks. I'm gonna say a word about them in a second. Then there is some normalization factors, which is not which is important that it's there, but there's nothing especially deep. And then on the other side, I have the bulk OP. So I'm going to have the three-point function coefficients, which are up there, and then the one-point functions of local operators, which I'm calling A. So they're fixed in terms of one number. I'm calling A. And then what we call bulk channel blocks. Okay, so defect channel on this side, bulk channel on this side, these two need to be equal, and this is a non-trivial constraint. So what I would like to say about the defect blocks at this stage is just that they're nicely factorized in terms of the polar coordinates down there. So it's there will be some function f. This is just some hypergeometric function, and some function of cos theta. So in particular, also in the quantum numbers. So there's a dependence on delta, which is associated to r, and the dependence on the spin, transverse spin associated to cos theta. This is basically just a consequence of the fact that the group, the preserved group here, is factorized. I'm not going to have to say much about the bulk blocks until a bit further, so I'm not going to do that. And this concludes the introduction. So now I would like to describe how to exploit this constraint. So let's describe the inversion of the defect of B. So what is the aim here? So we would like to extract information from that equation above. In particular, what I would like to do is to assume that I know something, and in fact, there's always something known about the bulk channel OP, and see what are the constraints on the defect channel OP in order for this equation to have a chance of being satisfied. But I would like to do this with a technology that allows me to do something more if a condition which I immediately confess I cannot prove, so I will assume that I will be more specific in the following, is satisfied about the asymptotics of the two-point function. So the technology will allow me to go from, say, a set of scaling dimension and transverse spins to some analytic function of S. So it will the function this technology will express the defect data in a way which makes manifest that they have to organize in regular trajectories. They must be basically the spectrum of a CFT, and hopefully also the defect CFT cannot be completely wild. I cannot just pick an operator and put it somewhere else and hope that the crossing equation is still satisfied. But the basic assumption here, differently from the case of the four-domain function, is left for future work in the sense that we couldn't prove it, and I will maybe say a word of why we couldn't. So, and also it will make manifest the existence of a 1 over S expansion, which is computable for this the spectrum and the associated OPE coefficients. Okay, so now I should stop and emphasize that here I'm using ideas that have been around for a while and in the context of a four-point function of regular translational invariant CFT, the existence of a 1 over S expansion has been first pointed out in a seminal work by Aldai and Maldacena in 2006, and then put in on more rigorous footing in the context of the bootstrap by two papers in 2012, one by Fitzpatrick, Kaplan, Poland, and Simon Zdafin, and the other by Komar, Goskin, Zibayedov. And finally, this technology, this inversion formula that I'm going to describe in this case, there's a nice formula for the four-point function, which was discovered by Simon Caronois last year. I should also mention that there's important work on the subject by Matthijs, by Balt, and by Balt van Ries. And some of, in particular, Matthijs' work is very much related to what I'm going to do exactly next. And so how do I get this formula? So this formula should pick the two-point function. It's an inversion formula, inversion of that OPE. So it should pick the two-point function and apply some integral transform that gives me back the OPE coefficients on the spectrum. So the first step to do that, to invert some expansion, is to try to express the expansion in terms of an orthogonal basis. If you can do that, then finding the coefficients of that expansion becomes easy. So the work for defect CFT, so in particular, this inversion form is far simpler for defect CFT than it is for four-point functions. So it's also a nice case study for subtleties and maybe extensions. So, and one reason why it's simple is that the blocks are so simple. So in particular, as I mentioned, the G are just Gegenbauer. So these are, well, in general, they're Gegenbauers. And these are already orthogonal. These are orthogonal polynomials. This is what they do. So here we're done. Have to do nothing. The functions, the parallel functions, this hypergeometric, are not orthogonal, but it's not hard to trade them for some orthogonal set, which is a combination of, I'm not going to make explicit the factors, but it's a simple proportionality factor. It's a combination between the block and the shadow block, the block which has this scaling dimension. And I would like not to spend too much time explaining how you can get to this proportionality factor, but if you want to be fancy, it's Sturm-Liouville theory. So there's some the Casimir operator can be made self-adjoint on a particular set of functions. In practice, in this case, it's a little bit more than building up a Fourier inversion. So it's especially simple. And once we have this basis, then you can exhibit this the following decomposition of the two-point function. The sum, and there's an integral over some contour. So these functions are only orthogonal when delta is chosen to be lying on the imaginary axis at real part pi half, p half. So this is the contour gamma that I'm picking. And then I'm defining a function b such that this decomposition holds, and I will say what is the property that b has to satisfy. So okay, the contour, as I said, in the delta complex plane is this. It goes up here, gamma at b half. And now, okay, imagine that b has poles located on the right for each operator that lies in the spectrum, delta hat that is actually exchanging the top b. Then we can simply pick this contour, close it to the right, pick up these simple poles, and if the residue agrees with the OP coefficient square up there, then we just explicitly get back the conformal block decomposition. So there's nothing, well, there's something slightly deeper than this, because it's not obvious that, so these are an infinite set of poles, so you should be a lot slightly more careful about convergence, but this can be fixed. So okay, so we have a condition for a function b to encode the OPE, and this this condition is that this function has poles whose residues is proportional to the OPE coefficient for each delta star that belongs to the spectrum of the theory.
What okay. happens to the shadow block?
Great. So when I close this contour, so this blocks, so this this prompts me to say one more thing about the blocks. These blocks go like r to the delta at large delta, and it's important that r is less than one. So you see here, I'm always staying in this circle, and so you want to close the contour here to the right, and you want to close the contour for the shadow in the other direction. So actually, since this, there is a shadow symmetry of this function, automatically this b, I can choose it to have poles also at the position of p minus delta star. So there will be also poles here. This factor a half is there basically just to ensure that the sum is still the right conformal decomposition.
Sorry, Marco, maybe you already said, but is this psi delta, is it a computable function or is it?
Yeah, it's a combination. This psi delta is an f to 1. I'm just not writing things, not because they're hard, but because they're easy. So I mean, it's just not, it's completely explicit. But I guess it should be very, very similar to your Jacobi function. It's good. So there was something else I may have wanted to say, but OK, let's not. OK, so OK. This is me, right? Good. Now, with this, I would like, I guess I have to speed up a bit, yeah? So, good, so now that we have this decomposition in terms of orthogonal function, the simplest thing we can do is just to, since they're orthogonal, invert it and get the function b. So, okay, we immediately have an expression that, again, I'm not going to be too careful with factors, but they can all be fixed very, very explicitly. Here, I'm introducing a new variable just because it's the most convenient one in the following. I'll say in a second. So when I invert, of course, I will have a measure, which is a measure that the orthogonal property of the psi's bring with them, and of course, of the Gegenbauer polynomials. That will be my basis. And then there will be the two-point function, or I should maybe put R and W. So W here, let me write it here, is just e to the I theta. Okay. And so the integral here goes over the unit circle in the complex W plane. Now, what is so this is an inversion formula, but it's not very deep. It's not very useful. In particular, it doesn't meet any of the properties up there. It's not explicitly analytic in S, because the Gegenbauer polynomials, these guys behave roughly like W to the S plus W to the minus S. OK, so this is clearly not something that I can compute around unambiguously, analytically continue around in the unit circle, because for generic S, this has a cut. So it's not analytic in S. It's also not clear what happens to this when I take a very large S. The asymptotics of the Gegenbauer polynomials are not extremely useful in this context. So, but there is a simple solution to this problem, which is to deform the contour. So if we could write, so this is going to be the W plane. I'm starting from an integral over modulus of W equal 1. If I could deform the contour so that I'm integrating these guys in over real W, then this would be immediately analytic in S, and I would meet the first goal. And OK, can I do that? So OK, to deform, I should know where the singularities are in the complex W plane for the two-point function. And it turns out that there are two cuts. I mean, better say there are branch points located at W equal R and W equal 1 over R. And OK, you can use the OPE to show that there's nothing else in a slightly careful way. But why are these branch points here? It's pretty easy to see. I should just draw maybe in a place which is more visible. Actually, what do I want to do? I can go back here. But this one over there, I think it doesn't go down. So yeah, so let me erase. So I would just like to point out that the real axis in W is a physical region in Minkowski. So now I should draw another plot, not anymore this one, but a plot in which the defect is a space-like defect. So it has a some light cone that goes from it. There is still my local operator, say phi, here. And if I fix at fixed r, varying w, I'm just picking up a trajectory which is an hyperbola in this plane. And clearly, there are two branch points associated to the light cone OPE with the other bulk operator. So this is nothing more fancy than that. And OK, here we have W going to 0. Here we have W going to infinity. So now that we know the cut, well, there are some additional cuts coming from the measure, but it's not very important. So this is all stuff that can be done very, very explicitly. So the only thing that we need to decide is whether we collapse the contour on this cut or we blow it up on this other one. And of course, the choice depends on if you want to pick this factor, the factor that grows, or the factor that is dumped in this functions. In general, these functions also have, I mean, this decomposition that I'm writing here is not generically valid. There are cuts, so it's a slightly different decomposition in the upper and lower out plane. But again, this is not deep. It's easy to take care of. So in particular, we close the contour here on this factor, and we close the contour at infinity, or we blow up the contour on this other factor. And here comes the condition that I need to meet in order to go from this picture to a picture in which I integrate only on the real axis. The condition comes from this small circle close to W equals 0. Which is in one direction, on the real direction, is this limit down there. But in more generally, it's not a limit which is in any. So for a general angle, it's not a limit which is either in Euclidean or in Lorentzian signature. I need to know that the function g, so this two point function, is polynomially bounded. So it's less than, say, w to the minus some s star when w goes to 0. OK, so this is analogous to what Simon Caron-Waud did for the Regge limit. But in that case, positivity of the OPE can be used to actually set this bound. And in our case, there's the channel, the OPE channel that converges around here. If you want, you could use this picture. The OPE channel that converges down here is the bulk OPE channel. The defect OPE channel, when this operator is fused to the defect, stops converging when I cross this light cone. But the bulk channel keeps doing fine. Problem is that the bulk channel is not positive, so at least not in general. So if it was positive, because you see there's no square on the right-hand side of that equation, so if it was positive, we would be fine, but in general, we're not. So I have to say, so this is, I'm not gonna be able to solve this problem. Just in examples we considered, it happened to be all right. It happened to be always polynomially bounded. So it's true that the formula I'm gonna write next is gonna be valid down to some finite spin, so it converges down to some finite spin. In general, I cannot prove this. It would be slightly unexpected, perhaps, to have correlation functions that just start growing exponentially in some region in which nothing very special is happening. But okay, this I don't really have. This is like it's not even work in progress. It's open problem because I'm not sure how to tackle it. So let's go ahead and assume that it works. Then the final formula I can write. I can also erase probably this.
So sorry, just to be sure I understand. So if there exists some S star.
If there exists some S star.
Then you can analytically continue down, until S star, let's say here.
Right, then if there is some S star for every, right, I should have said that, for every value of S, this is a function of S, right? So for all S bigger than S star, the circle can be dropped. Okay? And this is important. Does drop S to P? I guess so. So this is important because it's the fact that this was integrated along a circle was precisely the fact that was avoiding analyticity. Right? I need to have it integrated along the real axis. So dropping this circle is the condition for which this actual function that in origin was a collection or function for each integer s is actually an analytic function in S, which has in which those poles become codimension one singularities in delta and S. So okay, so the final formula, if I'm allowed to drop the circles, is just to maybe write this one explicitly. I go back to z and z bar coordinates because it's slightly more convenient in the following. And okay, there is some kernel here, which, as I was promising, is just some hypergeometric function, which is going to appear in a second. There is this factor is actually the important one. I would like to focus on the following. And then there's some unimportant stuff. So this has dependence on the dimension and codimension of the defect. So contrary to an advantage, so this problem is simpler, but an advantage of this problem respect to the situation respect to the four-point function is that this kernel is explicit, is just this. So there's nothing in the four-point function case here. There would be this block which has swapped scaling dimension and spin, but in general blocks are not known in closed form. Here it's completely known. And okay, so apart from the kernel, the other thing that there is of course the discontinuity of the function around the cut that the branch point that is at z bar equal 1. So here I should put maybe again coordinates. So so the branch point that I was showing down here, this guy. So by the way, there is a parity symmetry that tells me that this cut contributes exactly the same as this one. So I'm not going to care about that one anymore. So this singularity that was here was that Lightcon singularity, and it's the one around which we should take the discontinuity. And the region in which we're integrating is this one. Okay, so this is the Lorentzian inversion formula that I would like to use to get some asymptotic consequence. So let me transition to the third part. which is the large S sector. So,
So normally we imagine that the spectrum, maybe for some low twist operators, there is one operator for a given spin. But as the twist is bigger, there is a big degeneracy, there is some cloud of operators for a given spin. It's totally chaotic, and there is no meaning to following a single operator along the spin. Now, this register jacker is not that naive, right? It's not just going to the spectrum and following operators. Because even their number of operator changes as you change the spin. What exactly is the statement about regularity of the true spectrum and dimensions versus what we would naively expect? So naively, we expect clouds. Totally
curious.
But you say that, in fact, things are more analytic in S. What does it mean?
OK, so this is a very good question. I'm not sure if I know a very good answer, but it's true. So the statement, so that formula, if there is convergence, is telling you that this cloud, it's still not. So imagine that you have this cloud and you pick one operator and you decide, OK, there is a big cloud. I'm just going to move it a little bit. Right? It's not going to change much. There's a huge cloud of operators. What can happen if I move the operator a little bit? Well, this, if I just move the operator a little bit, there's going to be the same conformal block decomposition plus a piece which is proportional to a single conformal block. This piece will grow in spin, would grow at a large spin in a way in which it's gonna immediately change this S star. So even in the crazy cloud, etc., the existence of the trajectory means that there is a subset of operator. Well, there are infinitely many subsets of operators which are not independent of each other, because their sum should suppress the naive divergence that would come for the correlation function here. This doesn't mean, of course, that it's easy to follow this trajectory, but it means that they're not arbitrary. And then, yes, there is also the fact that these operators come and come more and more. So what I could expect is that there are trajectories that start at infinity, there are many, many operators, and then maybe they shoot up or they shoot down. They disappear somewhere, but they should disappear analytically. They don't get down to spin equals zero, but they're still there. At a certain point, they stop existing. So in the general situation, I have no idea if this is going to be a nice analytic story that at a certain point is just going to say, oh, look, this is the result. But it's for the four-point function, it's definitely true. For a defect CFT, it's true if this condition is met. So it's true in all the cases in which the condition is met. I don't have a better answer than this.
So for the four-point function, what regularity should one look like, should look for? Imagine if I have three-point functions and spectrum up to nine loops, like Frank is now playing with, and he has all this data. I don't know, some large twist operators, some huge spins.
Well, OK, so but
regularity we should look for
then. Okay. You would like, okay, I guess you would like the better answer than you know that at asymptotically large spin, there are these double twists and then you can follow them. But I mean, you can follow at least those trajectories, but you're saying, okay, there's many more, it's many much more wild. One thing I could, let me say this. As a matter of fact, in the plots that David Simons Duffin showed for the 3D Ising model, it's numeric, so that's honest numerics, and you see a bunch of operators you know they're stable. What happens is that the ones that are most stable are not necessarily the ones that have just low dimension, as you would have naively expected from the usual convergence property of the OP, they're the ones that have low twists. So these families are actually extremely visible, the first two or three families, even with the oscillation that here is not present, but in the four-point function is present. So you have some family in twist, and you have the spin, and there is this nice oscillation, even out spin. And this is actually present experimentally in the spectrum. So this is a clear regularity feature which is there. So that somehow the operators that are, of course, here there is clouds. You know, there are other operators, but they're unstable in the numerical bootstrap. So it seems they're the ones that are mostly important to, there is some regularity feature at least visible in those cases for the operators that are most important for reproducing the.
Those are double traces, right? So I
yes.
Commit that I have two single traces, like two planets.
Yes.
And then I separate them with spin, and then I study the Newton force between the two of them.
Right.
And that's why it would be regular, right? Because it's like studying. I don't change them, I just separate them, right?
Right.
As soon as I say that by increasing spin, I can also change the inner structure of the operators, because there are many, I doubt you will have any structure. So here it's because you only have like two planets, right? It's sigma and epsilon in the Ising model.
Well, yeah, but in this...
In theory, with many operators, when you add spin, you can either put spin between them, or you can add a few units of spin to the operator, to the single trace, and how are you going to easily...
No, yeah, I'm not sure if they could be easily disentangled in a generic situation. But yeah, okay. But also here, it's not, I mean, okay, there's just sigma and epsilon. But for instance, one feature that should appear is that, I mean, there are at least, so in this case, you would say, okay, there are sigma and epsilon, but there are also all the multi-traces, which are more complicated object of sigma and epsilon, right? So you, all those, they're less evident from the bootstrap point of view, but you can actually see that they're necessary for crossing symmetry. So even those operators, you can predict what they're going to do at least at large spin. So I'm not sure that if the 3D Ising model is really too trivial of a theory, but I agree that this does not mean that... that it's going to be easy to solve the theory. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, even the example that I'm going to present in the last 10 minutes is going to be a weakly coupled example that checks the formula, the analyticity in a case in which it's completely weakly coupled. So just to check that what we did is makes sense. In a generic strongly coupled situation, I don't have an answer which is better than what I gave. Sorry.
For fixed S, is this function B delta hat shadow symmetric?
Yes. So I'm not, this function that I wrote is not, because I'm just, I dumped the shadow symmetric part, which is not important. So, okay, let me just comment, like give a quick comment about the large S spectrum and then just present the example. I also promised that this formula was going to give a calculable 1 over S expansion. And it does, because here I'm integrating between 1, I mean, in this region, so Z bar is bigger than 1. Now imagine I want to go to large S. You can forget about this factor. You can show that it doesn't grow. So this is exponentially suppressed unless Z bar is very close to 1. This is a nice advantage of the inversion formula with respect to the Lightcon bootstrap, for those of you that are used to the other approach. In the Lightcon bootstrap, you don't have a knob. You cannot just tune S. You need to go and understand, if you look in a certain region in this plot, what is going to dominate. Here it's automatic. I crank up S here, and the formula tells me what is going to dominate. And what is going to dominate is the region of all this region here, is actually the region close. I should draw something like this. So it's a region close to Z bar equal 1. This is the region that gets enhanced. So OK, so this is a region in which the bulk of B converges very well. The operators are light-like separated. So we don't need to do computations. It's just saying, OK, what is happening at S equal infinity? Or we don't need to do computation at the leading order. What is happening at S equal infinity? It's happening that I can replace the discontinuity of G with the discontinuity of just the lowest twist operators, as I said at the beginning, lowest twist dominating the Lightcon limits, the lowest twist operator which is exchanged in the bulk of P. And that's the identity. So good. So it means that the extremely large spin sector asymptotically is just the same as the spectrum of a theory that only, in which the only operator that gets a VEV in the presence of the defect is the identity operator. But that's, again, we do not need to do computations over it, because if no theory gets a VEV, there's no defect. So this means that a large, very large spin, all defect conformal field theories just trivialize. They just go back to not seeing the defect at all. And what are the defect operators on a trivial defect? Well, they're just a Taylor expansion. So every defect spectrum will have, for asymptotically large S, will be structured like this. And let me also put the size of the correction. So these operators are just derivatives. So I pick the operator phi I put a bunch of derivatives in front, so it gives a charge S, and perhaps a few derivatives which are contracted, which is responsible for this plus 2m. It's just these are what we call transverse derivative operators that are there now in any defect CFT. So as I promised, this means that not any theory with a global symmetry can be and without a stress sensor can be a defect conformal field theory. It can be just a coupled to a bulk. It needs to have a spectrum in which the dimension is related linearly to the charge at large spin, which is non-trivial. Good. So the correction goes down like a power of tau, a power of s, and the power is decided by whatever the next operator with low twist is here. With respect to the four-point function, there is a factor a half that you can just track. That's fine. You can also explain in this Aldai-Maldacena picture. It works. And it's computable. So you can actually go on and compute. And in the last 5 minutes, I would like to actually show, well, rather than explicitly do the computation, show just an example in which you can get the finite result and check that it works. So in particular, you can extract all the OP coefficients and the scaling dimension down to spin zero in a very simple example. So the example is what is called the Rennie twist operator, and in particular in the limit in which it computes entanglement entropy. So let me just actually there's one feature I would like to say before we go there, because it's important, I think. So this formula up to here, so how does it work? How do poles arise? So poles arise because this part of the formula, the integral over z bar, this big chunk, will give you some stuff which is some as an expansion as powers of delta. So this is it's not that I can do it explicitly in a generic case, but I know it has to be in this way because I know from the Euclidean formula that this has the right poles. So the way in which I create poles in tau hat, which is this delta hat here, is by having some z to some power, so that when I tune tau to be equal to that power, actually here I need to put them. Ah no, there's a minus one there. I have a pole. So this is how it works. The nice feature is that this chunk, it's actually not just an asymptotic expansion when s is big. In this thing, I can replace the conformal block, the bulk block decomposition in G, and it's a convergence sum because at every fixed z, I'm integrating from here down to some point here, which is completely included in the regional convergence of the bulk OP. Except the bulk OP stops converging when I take z going to zero, and this creates problems in actually using this formula for systematically enlarged spin. So this is what I'm also saying some future work for the conclusion. And this is still to be done. So when I want to extract the spectrum as so that square there should be some sum of powers of z, some tau star half, right, somewhere tau star. I would like to look at the small z limit. But the small z limit is precisely the limit in which this sum stops converging. I need more and more bulk operators in order to describe better and better the integral down here, which is the reason why when I was drawing something like this, the region that matters. And this has actually like a physical explanation. If I want to reconstruct this full power, I need the theory to present accumulation points in twist space. Remember that higher order corrections come weighted by the twist, but if there are, as there are, double twist operators in the theory, at certain point I meet an accumulation point in twist and infinitely many operators contribute. And clearly, then the point is that I cannot just sum them one by one. I would not get the right result. I would just get logs instead of powers. And instead, one needs techniques to actually first resum contributions of entire families of operators, the double trace operators, and then invert them. This is an open, a future direction, which is anyway has been already developed for the case of a four-point function, and so it can be also developed in this case. So back to the example. The example is precisely an example in which I don't need to do this, so we can compute. And okay, very quickly. So this is an example of a defect. we still have 5 minutes, right? This is an example of a defect which has intrinsically a weak coupling parameter. Which I'm going to call n. So let me just remind you. So let's say Reni twist defect. The Reni twist defect is an extended operator that computes the following quantity, which is called Reni entropy. That is a one-parameter family of quantities, parameter n, computes the trace of the density matrix obtained by taking taking a CFT, which I have time, I have a spatial slice, dividing the spatial slice in, say, two, since I would like to have a flat defect, as I was saying at the beginning, so this is going to be at the constant time slice. I want to trace over the region A bar of the Hilbert space, and this gives me a density matrix. I'm doing this in the vacuum. This gives me a density matrix. I would like to raise it to the nth power and take the trace. So this gives me the Reni entropies, and in particular, the limit for n going to 1 less n is entanglement entropy. So the only thing I would like to say about why this is computed by it has a chance of being computed by a conformal defect is that since I'm doing something, so this is, I'm fixing a constant time slice, so this point is actually a codimension 2 surface. It's the only place where I'm actually doing something, so it's the only place where translational invariance is broken, for an integer n at least. So the picture you should have in mind is that in order to compute this nth power, I need to, this is a matrix that has indices, I need to contract the indices row and column, so I'm going to pick n copies of the CFT. I'm going to construct density matrix over each copy. So this means that I should trace over A bar. It means that actually I should glue the path integral above and below in the region A bar and leave it open in the region A. And then take the product with the next density matrix. So in practice, I'm going to have a cut here. It's going to be, the theory is going to come as a sheet up here. See if I can draw this in a way which makes sense. And here I need to glue the upper part down with the next copy of the CFT. And so on and so forth. Okay, so this is a replicated geometry in which the only thing that is happening is actually here. So in this codimension 2 point, I break translational invariance. Now, it's a non-trivial fact that this can actually be this construction, which is conformal, it's a defect, actually still works for complex values of n, so it can be analytically continuous. It's something that was established, was argued at least by Tom Faulkner recently. And the way in which it works is by carefully doing the analytic continuation. The only thing I actually need in order to compute a two-point function, I mean, this is an advantage of this approach, is that I knew this was going to happen. Is that I don't need to actually know too much about how the analytic continuation is done, except a few facts. So let me just state the two facts and then state how they can be used and the result that I would like to present, which is a defect spectrum of a two-point function of scalar operators with this defect. So the two facts are that one, I'm allowed to consider operators that lie in the quotient CFT to the n divided by the permutation symmetry of the theory. So only singlets under Zn, singlets. So in particular, among the singlets, I have single copy operators that are obtained by summing over, if it was from 1 to n, the operator, let me denote the copy of the theory, the sheet on which it is placed by the parentheses. So if I have an operator in the CFT, a singlet combination is just a sum over the operator placing all the copies. And this is invariant under Zn. And then there are double copies operators, for instance, phi 1, phi 2, which are labeled by some other integer, in which I'm still summing, but I'm putting one operator on copy I, and the other operator I'm putting on copy, say, I plus k. Okay, so this guy is a sum over I of phi I. This guy's is a sum over I, where I have an operator in copy I and an operator in the copy I plus, well, I plus k and I. Okay, there's a phi here, the phi here. The second fact I need, these are the only operators that whose correlation functions are going to still obey the axioms of a defective theory. I'm going to have a conformal block decomposition for generic values of n. The second fact is that the only the stress tensor, only the VEV of the stress tensor is different from zero, or say it is of the order n minus 1. All the other operators among the single copy. Okay, so when n goes to 1, the defect disappears. I don't have any copy anymore. There's no defect at all. So the VEV start at order n minus 1. The only single copy operator that has a VEV is the stress tensor. All the other operators that get a VEV are double copy or higher copies. And this is another consequence of the unity continuation. And this is enough, actually, to just apply the formula, because I can state the example. Consider consider a two-point function of a scalar. I could probably do this and then bring down this. Consider a two-point function of a scalar which is a single copy operator. So phi, phi. I would like, as I promised, to replace the bulk copy here, you know, and then to use the formula to have the spectrum. And I know there are infinitely many operators contributing, so this two-point function is non-trivial, because there are in the OP of phi with phi, there are all the operators that arise when phi goes to phi on the same copy, but then there are a bunch of operators that arise when phi goes with phi on different copies. So, but among the single copy operators, only property 2, only the stress tensor gets a VEV. And the double copy operators have dimensions which are just the ones of exact double twist. So in phi times phi, I only have t. And then I have stuff which has dimension delta 2 delta phi plus integers. Right? Because there's no singularity in the OP when I bring the two operators together on different copies. And now, OK, now this is why the formula is very efficient in this case. This is at order n minus 1, so for entanglement entropy in this limit. Now, all these guys are present because a single conformal block is not crossing symmetric, so their purpose in life to ensure crossing symmetry, but they have zero discontinuity. They disappear once I plug them in here. So they do nothing in order to create anomalous dimensions for defect operators. The anomalous dimensions for the defect operators just come from the block of the stress, from the stress tensor block. So once I have all the anomalous dimensions of the defect operators, I can just resum them if I actually need the correlation function and get the correlation function without basically doing any computation, because the stress tensor one-point function is a kinematical object. The only other thing that I need is the one-point function, actually, the number of the stress tensor, which is known. It can be just computed in a generic CFT. So the final result that one gets is that the transverse twist of the operators, defect operators that appear inside the defect OP of the single copy operator is something like delta phi. So these are transverse derivatives as we discussed, minus something of order n minus 1. And then, OK, just to conclude and see that things can be done explicitly, in this case, this is some analytic function of S, which turns out to be correct if you actually do the computation honestly of the correlation function and you do the conformal block decomposition. You guess the general form, you get exactly this. So it's sample Kammer plus order n minus 1 squared. So there are cases in which actually this is using the formula is not just giving you universal result at large bin, but gives you analytic results in an easier way than actually doing the full computation. And with this, and I would just like to say that, I already said some future problems, future question. This is one thing that one should immediately, one should do is to do the large spin, make the large spin expansion, this expansion systematic. It can be done, I think. And other, just as slogans, other obvious directions are doing the inversion, construct the inversion formula for spinning external operators. Since the form, since all formulas are very easy, it should be easy to do it. And in particular, two-point function of stress tensors, say in entanglement entropy case, bear a lot of information. And do the opposite, invert the bulk copy. Do exactly the opposite. Well, now I erase, but do exactly the opposite inversion. Assume that I know something about the defect of PE. I know, for instance, that some operator gets a valve. What are the operators that are responsible for reconstructing that valve in the cross channel? And with this, I'd like to conclude, and thank you very much for your attention.
Any question?
And so say you have a monodromy defect, so there's some group action if you move a field along the defect. Can you, like, does precisely this formula apply, or is there some interesting interplay then?
I think precisely this formula applies. The unique thing that you should bear in mind is that when this is so, what is the only difference? When it's, so these monodromy defects are codimension two things. Codimension two as the transverse factor is a U1 factor. It has representations that might not be integer spins. And so in the case of a monodromy, in general, you will have operators on the defect which transform. With fractional spin. And so the only modification is that here, basically, the Gegenbauer polynomial that I was mentioning at the beginning that turn into this kind of F2-1 of 0 over z bar should be just replaced by simple exponential. So e to the I s theta is the point is that s could be non-integer. But that's fine. It's so the formula slightly changes because in some pieces of the derivation, I did assume that s was integer until the very end. But in the 2D case, it could be integer plus rational, and everything would go through. And in particular, you can actually apply it. Another example that in which you can compute things is something that was computed in. So you can reproduce some leading order epsilon expansion results that are in the literature. There's Davide, Dalimil, and Miguel are responsible for them for the easing, for the twist effect in epsilon expansion in 4 to the 4th theory. And yes, so there are operators that are half integer spin. And they're actually, even if it doesn't look like, right, they have half integer spin, they're not, they cannot be written in this way explicitly, but they are transverse derivative operators. This the only correction that survives is actually a 1 over s correction down to spin 0. It's non-trivial. If you just do the large spin expansion, you get all the orders in S, and you just compute the full contributions that you have. The blocks, this inversion, just order by order in S cancels and gives you the right 1 over S factor with the right coefficient. So it works.
Any other question? Not less than a mark per then.
Thank you.